Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough. This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me, I've waited long enough.
As I gaze upon the beautiful abyss of outer space, I can't help but reminisce on how we held on to our faith. Gold is how we stayed till the day that time would say that Toonami's back, bitches. Pardon my francais. Now every week the absolution blasts off while the masses watch as an old familiar mascot by the name of Tom takes a seat and kicks the broadcast off, making major moves like a triple cut backdrop. I still remember watching that Beyond doing damage and thinking, damn, is Goku ever gonna reach Namek? Obviously I got a lot of love for the classics. The speed at which I used to run home to watch was the fastest. Absolution moving, flying through the galaxy. Toonami's back, the slap in the face to those who doubted it. Remain Toonami faithful to the day that I am gray and old, and like a Super Saiyan's glow, I will always stay gold.
This is Nerdcore Absolution. Come to peace with your inner nerd, and after you can stay gold like T.O.M. Chilling out the galaxy and we know him. Putting tunes up that'll keep you up. Glued to the screen like you knew too much. The galaxy is ours, the sun and the stars. Toonami's on and chilling hard.
Watching closely from a perch among the stars as viewers await the moment when the spirit bomb can.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. This is episode 127 of The Prerogative, and this time out we start of what is hopefully three reviews this month, all revolving around love, maybe four if I can get to it. But we start out the month of love, because, you know, I have to theme everything. We're looking for a series that is, well, one of the central themes is love itself. It's a magical girl animation that I actually think, personally, and this may rub some people the wrong way, is better than Sailor Moon. Now, before you get your pitchforks and fire and everything and burn me at the stake, just hear me out, because while Sailor Moon is such a great series, as I'll get to in a second, I just think this is more has that sort of more element that speaks to at least younger girls, where Sailor Moon might be a more towards the teenage girl. I'll get to all that in a second to explain my blasphemy. But what series am I talking about? Well, I am talking, of course, about the other Magical Girl series that became popular in the late 90s and early 2000s over on Fox. Its theme song started with something about, you know, talking about wind, fires, water, wood, and the secret of the cloud was all a mystery. But when this mighty book was opened, the powers were set free. God Captors is the series we're talking about, and today we review Cardcaptors, the first movie. So, yes, Cardcaptors, the first movie. All that work just to say that. But, you know, this is a series I have been wanting to review on Tom's Prerogative for a long, long time. And part of that definitely dealing with the controversial statement I may have just made right there. Saying that I think it's better than Sailor Moon. Now, I like Sailor Moon. A lot of people like Sailor Moon. There are guys out there that say, oh, I'm a guy. I don't like Sailor Moon. Those are the guys who are afraid to admit that they get the Sailor Moon doujins and, how do I put this in PG? Let's just say they fantasize. There's nothing wrong with saying that the Sailor Moon girls are lovely, but I'm one of those guys, being the hopeless romantic I am. I fully remember getting up and being very, very involved and caring about whether, you know, Serena and Cito Max get together and all the love, because I was a hopeless romantic. I have no problem in it. I am proudly a hopeless romantic. I've said that many times. So, I'm not saying that Sailor Moon is bad. I like Sailor Moon, but I think that Sailor Moon speaks to more older girls, where if you want to talk about a magical girl show that maybe speaks to younger girls, and that's what you're looking for, Cardcaptor Sakura, I think, is a much, much better series in regards to that. Of course, Cardcaptor Sakura, created by the legendary Clamp, which is a group of female manga artists. They've done many great series. Maybe my brain can catch up to my mouth. they've done many great series besides Cardcaptor Sakura, X, Tsuburaya, Chronicles, which is a more recent series that is much below. In fact, let me bring up their list right now, because they've done so many stuff. If I get to their list, here we go. RG Vega, Man of Many Faces, Tokyo Babylon, Clamp School Detectives, X/199, Legendary Chung Han, Magical Knight Reyes, Miyuki-chan in Wonderland, The One I Love, Clover Wish, Angelica Layers, Chobits, Exholic, like I said, Super Mario, Reservoir Chronicles, Gate 7, starting in 1989, so many legendary series like Chobits, and not all these series necessarily have happy endings. I can speak, for example, from watching the X/1999 movie. You want to sort of be depressed, watch that movie. I'm not saying it's bad or good. I'm just saying you want to be depressed. Okay, spoiler for nobody who's seen that movie. Everybody dies! Yeah, it's that type of movie. But Cardcaptor Sakura may be probably their most well-known. It's certainly one of their most popular, probably along with Chobits and Magical Knight Reyes. And of course, like I said, Tsuburaya Chronicles is a series that actually toured that whole crossover idea where they have basically, they take characters, they sort of recreate them in a way, give them different backstories. In this case, it's Lee and Sakura from Cardcaptors, and then have them go through all like the Clamp worlds. So, Clamp is a very, very famous anime group, or anime creator group, creating manga that go to anime. But going back to the whole Sailor Moon Cardcaptors thing, I just think that it speaks more as far as to little girls, and you know, the theme of love, it's not just some theme of like, oh, it's girls, it's theme of love. It's a carefully plotted story with a central theme of love done by girls for girls. And the thing that's great about it is, even though that may be the idea, what makes Clamp so good is the fact that while they may be speaking more from a female point of view, their series are series that can speak to everybody, and that's what makes them so good and so beloved. So in that sense, I just think on a purer sense, Cardcaptors is better than Sailor Moon. I just think it can speak to more people and is better suited, honestly, for a younger female demographic than Sailor Moon is. So in other words, Cardcaptor Sakura is for girls of all ages, where I think Sailor Moon, quite honestly, is not suited for anybody under the age of 13, or at least on the female side. Or at least in certain places, because Sailor Moon is more blunt, whereas Cardcaptors is more subtle in its story, as we'll talk about. So, of course, I'm reviewing the first movie, which came out in 1999. But, of course, probably didn't reach theaters. And I looked down at my notes, which is so totally not Wikipedia. It was released on film, at least in Japan, in 2000. I believe Pioneer did an edit that was in 2002. Yeah, the thing that's very interesting, it's actually had multiple English dubs, where I think focused more on the I believe it's the Pioneer dub, which was the first initial dub done to it of the Cardcaptor series for Fox. So there's like some Ocean Group guys and there, some well-known voice actors, Samuel Vincent Matt Hill, people we've heard in other series, Maggie Blue O'Hare, you might remember from X-Men Evolution, Shadowcat, aka Kitty Pryde. So there are some similar voice actors. I do believe this is the Ocean Group version, which was, like I said, the original for Fox. And that was the thing that's also to discuss about here, is, you know, as part of the Toonami generation, we talk a lot about Toonami, and obviously Toonami was a big thing in Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z and Gundam Wing and all that, but it's also would be impossible not to talk about the other anime coming out on other channels that were definitely inspired by Toonami's success. You know, Fox, because of Toonami's success with more anime-like projects, would ultimately bring more series to its Saturday morning cartoon shows. Of course, also, we cannot forget the huge success of Pokemon, which would lead to the bringing of shows like Digimon. But with Toonami's success, would maybe more, I don't want to say adult and maybe matures, but sort of series that target more older viewers with shows like Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z and Gundam Wing, they started to bring shows that had sort of a little bit more maturity to it, and Cardcaptors is one of those series. Like I said, that came early 2000s, and of course there's always changes, but you know, sometimes those changes could be the good things, you know. For instance, with Cardcaptors, you know, I sort of kind of made the joke at the beginning. I wonder if MD caught it. Probably not. But I sort of made reference to the fact of, what do we know Cardcaptors for? Probably the most. We know that theme song. You know, where they're going through the name of the cards and the secret of the cloud. And then goes right into the theme song, which is a very catchy theme song. You know, Cardcaptors, a mystic adventure. Cardcaptors, a quest for all time. I don't even need to look at lyrics. I remember them in my head. So that theme song, that great catchy sort of theme song that I quite honestly believe deserves to be right up there, at least in the top 20 of those like great cartoon theme songs that are catchy and stick in your head, because it is a very fun theme. It gives you the whole premise of the show in this short 30-second, 45-second theme song. It's got a catchy tune, and obviously I can remember to this day. And I haven't seen that English version in ages. I did watch the opening the other day, but that was just, you know, because remembering it made me want to see it. So, you have that. But it was during, you know, again, Fox, Digimon. I do remember sort of Fox catering more to more mature content in there. I mean, still for children, but the stories being a little bit more advanced. You saw those things like I said, Cardcaptors, one of them. This is also during the time that, again, because of Gundam Wing's popularity, they tried out bringing Escaflowne, and Escaflowne just was a bit too mature for them. A lot of people think Escaflowne, especially since they've shown the movie and stuff, was a series that was on Cartoon Network. It never made it onto Toonami. It actually was shown on Fox, along with other shows like Martian Nadesco, and other shows like that. So, Cardcaptors was one that succeeded and actually had a long run. And it is a favorite series of mine, especially as coming from childhood, of remembering getting up on Saturday mornings to watch it. So, this is the first movie. And why don't we get right into the review, which of course means it's time to go over synopsis. So, in Japan, there is a young girl named Sakura Avalon. She's getting C in music. She loves to roller skate. No, one more thing. She's a magical girl. More precisely, she is the true successor now to the magic of the legendary magician Clow Reed. She She did this by opening a book in a library one day and releasing the cloud cars, which she now must hunt down. Which she does with her friends Madison, her friend slash rival Lee Shauron, and of course Lee's friend Mayin. They hunt down cloud cards and seal them to gain their power and use. Well, as spring break is coming up in Japan, everybody's preparing for their vacations. And Sakura and Madison going to the mall, check out things, come upon a chance drawing where they get to pick a ball and the color of the ball decides what prize you get. And it just so happens, Sakura gets the gold ball. And what does the gold ball get you? A trip to Hong Kong. And I'm sure it had nothing to do with any magical forces trying to get her to go there by helping her pick the gold ball. Well, Sakura, Madison, and of course her brother Tori, along with his friend and Sakura's secret crush, Julian, all go on a trip to Hong Kong. You know, Japan's favorite place to the show in series, because Lord knows we were just there in G Gundam. But of course, while there, the trip goes smoothly until mystic forces pull Sakura into events of a vengeful love long lost. Can Sakura get out of this one? We'll find out as we review Card Captor Sakura, the first movie. Welcome back, and let's get right into it. We start off with music, and starting off with music, we have to kind of talk about the sort of Jekyll and Hyde effect with music here. Oddly enough, depending upon how you look at that saying, either, you know, I'm doing it in the whole, you know, Jekyll is good and Hyde is bad. Some might view it as Hyde being more interesting and Jekyll being the sort of more boring part. I would like to think most people are taking it the first way, which is what I'm doing here. I find it interesting that we're actually starting off with the sort of Mr. Hyde, the bad aspect of the music with the songs. Now, of course, what you heard was the ending, the sort of ultimate theme song of the movie. And it is really well done, and it's a nice song, especially towards the end. I like it. It's a very lovely theme song. It definitely feels like sort of one of those good kid pop songs talking about love and all of those themes. So I do enjoy it as sort of an ending theme. It's a nice sort of movie ending theme for an anime. But again, for the most part, when we're talking about songs and music in that standpoint, we're talking about actually more of what's in the movie itself. There is no sort of opening song. What's the sort of Japanese theme song that's like behind the title sequence? But there are sort of songs. Now, I did not listen to the Japanese version. Again, this is the English dub. And for the English dub, they put in English songs. The songs themselves kind of remind me sort of similar in a way of songs that they've put in other sort of animes that where they've redone the songs. I'm trying to think of the one that it reminds me of. It's almost kind of like Digimon, the first movie, except that those were actually good and actually seemed themed around, you know, the actual series, you know. Now, here we go. Here we go! No, that seemed actually themed around the movie. Here, they were sort of very, these, like, sort of popish pop songs sung by girls. I don't know what was going on. I heard things of chasing love. Like, you don't hear them long enough to actually, because it goes by so quick. They're, like, using sort of montage scenes and stuff like that. Like, scenes where they're running around and looking at all the sights of Hong Kong, or they're chasing these birds, or whatever. It just, it's like, here's a scene, for whatever reason, we're going to put music behind it. I don't know if it was like that in the Japanese version. And if there was no music there, it's one of those things where the Americans are like, well, we need to keep people's attention, so we'll put this song in there to, you know, keep people's attention. Regardless of whichever way, the songs didn't catch my ear. They didn't sound interesting. They were these, they just sounded like pop songs that were put in there because girls might like them, and again, for reasons I've said before. So they really didn't add anything to the movie, and that's ultimately the problem. I don't feel like they added anything to the movie. Part of that, I think, is because they're too low, and because of that, you can't make out what they're saying, and if they're being used in a montage, in particular, music really needs to lend itself to that montage to add something. You know, let's look at the most famous use of music in a montage. You know, You're the Best Around, which is done with Karate Kid. You know, You're the Best Around, never gonna let you down, as they're training. And that actually adds something to the montage. I mean, it's a classic sort of 80s style thing, you know, they add music. But again, it was always with the idea that if you pick the right song, the music will add something to the story being told in the montage. In particular, with sort of the montage scenes here where they use the pop songs, and I had to, like, go back to the scenes again and listen to them. It just didn't sound like the songs really were connected. They had some slight sort of connection to what's going on, but not enough to where it feel like it added or helped tell the story of the montages. In fact, the animation in those montage scenes and scenes like that did a fine enough job of telling the story that I don't even think the music was needed. I mean, I think the best one was sort of the early one as they get off the boat, and it's this sort of like Chinese song, and I think that was an instrumental, which would be more with the score. And if so, that did a whole lot more of telling the story. Because again, it was them going through the sights of Hong Kong, and it had a very Chinese theme to it. Again, like, this is, well, this is 99, so this was when China had taken over Hong Kong. Because China, I believe, took over Hong Kong in, at the end of 1998. And I always remember that because that was one of the central themes around Rush Hour with Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker, which is always going to be one of my favorite movies. And if you've not seen Rush Hour, the original Rush Hour, shame on you. Go out and watch it. It's Chris Tucker at his best. It's one of Jackie Chan's best movies, quite honestly. And Jackie Chan has a lot of great movies. But I think Jackie Chan, and again, this is off topic, but Jackie Chan is like, that's his best complete performance. It's, there are better martial arts movies that are sort of more better comedies, maybe, that he's done. But as far as that complete package, maybe Rumble in the Bronx is the one that can compete with it. And I know that's off topic here, but I think that shows you just how much of an impact of the songs in the movie had an impact on me. They didn't. So there's a lot left to be said for that, and that's why it's sort of the Mr. Hyde. On the other hand, the Dr. Jekyll here, the good stuff is the actual score, which is beautifully done. There's a lot of great thematic music when they're in Hong Kong with Chinese themes and the use of Chinese instruments that sort of talk about that heritage, and a lot of great scores with undercutting sort of mystic themes, along with scores that are brought over from the series that I recognize that are just beautifully well done. And again, that are being done more orchestral here, full orchestral, I should say, for the movie. Again, a lot more impact and definitely still fit. I think one of the best scores actually in the movie is in that final fight scene. And I have issues with the way it ends and everything, but I just think the score throughout it was beautifully done and really told the story beats that they were telling. It helped tell those beats really, really well. We're going to get more into sort of that ending sequence and everything later, in particular when we get the story. Because like I said, I have some issues, but I'll explain when I get the story, because there's really no way to get into talking about that without talking about it. But in regards to here, just focusing on the music in that scene, what they were trying to tell, they were able to tell, and part of that reason was the music definitely helped lend itself to the musical elements helping tell that story. And that's how it was pretty much for the entire score. There's many great moments where the music sometimes being, not deafening, but there's a lot of music, or whether there's little music, and just sort of certain facts, like, for instance, when Sakura is being pulled to the well the first time, and there's music as part of the chase, but as she gets there, the music stops, there is no music. All the sound there is, like, natural sound, like birds chirping and walking on grass, and you don't hear anything. And you don't hear anything until she gets to the well and looks, and you hear chime sounds. As opposed to other scenes where it's this tension music that's really well done and everything. So the overall score is just brilliantly done. It's very beautiful. I'd definitely buy the soundtrack because it's a really great soundtrack. Music is done by Takayuki Nagishi. Did a wonderful job. So yeah, there's a definitely Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde effect with the music. The score is beautifully done, but sort of the little pop songs added in during the movie really don't add anything and are really forgettable. The only sort of song that's good is the ending thing, which is beautiful to listen to. But again, you know, as Deadpool would say, not that I was able to go to the movie because I don't have a state ID, and apparently no one can look at me and say that I'm 30. Maybe if I would have kept my beard. Reminds me of the fact that when I went to go see Blade Trinity, when I was over 18 and was able to get in, I had a bunch of 15-year-olds trying to sneak in, asking me to tell the movie usher that I was their father. Either I'm too old or they think I'm too young, and they don't win! I'm getting off track. I'm sorry. But, yeah, the ending theme, I enjoy it, but outside of that, the songs are really forgettable from the movie. Outside of that ending theme. So music, for the important parts, is done actually very well as far as the score. That's the thing about the music, again, I didn't watch the Japanese version, so I can't tell you if they were songs in there, but if they were just something that the American dub just put in to keep people's attention, they didn't need to do it. It didn't work, but it's not something that really hurts the movie, because they're only done in a couple scenes, and again, like I said, the overall score definitely picks up the slack and really lends itself to helping tell the overall story. And I'll sort of talk about theme here a little bit, because you'll hear me talk about it over and over again. It's sort of the theme of vengeful love and the love that is forgiven. We'll get more into that when we get into the story. But let's actually move on to animation. The overall animation style is beautiful to look at because it's Clamp. It's Clamp artistic style put on screen. The thin lines and everything, and they're beautifully well done. The art is just gorgeous throughout this entire movie. production, it was written by Nagase Okakawa from Clamp, and featured character designs by Kumiko Takahashi, which was based off Clamp's original designs. The art director was Katsufumi Haruyu. Haruyu. I hope I'm pronouncing that wrong. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Did I just say I hope I'm pronouncing that wrong? I'm sorry. I mean, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Yeah. There's really no way to come back from that, is there? But the art is just beautiful. From everything. And we're going to get more into art here. We'll start with those character designs. You know, as I said, they're based off the designs, the original illustrations by Clamp. And the character design is really, really well done. Especially with the stories the character designs tell. And I'll start off with Sakura's. I love Sakura's design. I really think that Sakura's design is something that should be taught in classes. As far as in the regards of how to design a character that can appeal to everyone. Yet still sort of retain its gender. It's the connection it's most going to have. In this regards, still retaining its femininity and still retaining probably the group that it's most going to connect to, which is young girls. But at the same time, being a character that just design-wise can appeal to everyone as far as designing a character that people can connect with. You know, the thing about Sakura's design that I love the most, above anything else, is that you look at a design, you just look at the characters at the movie, and the character feels like something that, you know, I see a piece of me in that character. And that's why I really love the design. You know, and that also is partly due to the fact of how they move the character and everything. She's a girl, but there's elements that are not too girlish, and though she's not a tomboy, it's something human. You know, there are very human elements that people connect to that aren't towards any one gender. And that's really important to designing, in particular, a main protagonist that a lot of people can connect to. And I think the important part about any design of characters, you can't just design a character to be human. It has to come naturally. You know, it comes from saying, well, yeah, we were targeting this group, but we decided to do a little twist here and there. And it's usually those little twists here and there to add that human element that people can connect to. Sakura is a perfect example of that. There's a lot of elements within her that people of any gender, any race, any religion, whatever, can connect to. And it makes her such an interesting and fun protagonist to watch, because you see a bit of yourself in there. And I think part of also what helps that is ultimately that the designs of the other characters sort of lend themselves to helping tell that story and making that connection, with Madison being a lot more feminine with the long hair and the pristine and sort of clothes, sort of the rich girl and everything, seeming more high class, you know, sort of the angry, almost overtly masculine yet still feminine look of Li Xiaoran, Mei Ling being the more athletic type. All of those actually help lend itself to helping the overall design of Sakura connect more with being sort of in that middle ground. In particular with Mei Ling and Madison, you know, Madison being a lot more on the feminine side, Mei Ling leaning more towards that athletic, more masculine side. And then you have Sakura in the middle, and that, again, it lends to all the designs connecting, and the design work is just beautiful for all the characters. They look like kids, but they also make them feel not like kids. And so that really makes the design work, and really makes the characters work within the movie. Moving on to the action scenes. The action scenes are done. I wish there was more. I wish they were longer. But for what they are, they're good. You know, this is not necessarily a series that is done to appeal to action fans. But there is still action in it, and it's very well done. And again, the streamlining, the way things move, they do a great job of making things seem go faster than they are. Like, Sakura's flying, and she's flying along. It seems like she's flying really fast, yet somehow the camera is able to still focus on her. It's that great use of drawing movement to where you're making the audience believe the character is moving fast and everything. That's really done work, the line work, just the way, you know, spell is moving everything and they flow. And they have that magical touch as though the spells feel alive. So, in that sense, the action scenes are really well done. In particular with the magic and the way making the magic match sort of the elemental work it's behind. Whether it be the use of water magic and the water flowing, you know, in particular with the protagonist. Sayun, the sorceress. You know, particularly the way she moves. And this also goes to character design, which is really well done. The red and everything, and the symbolism of sort of the red color, that's sort of symbol of vengeance, almost. Red and black in there. But then you have those sort of white cloths that moved out, and the way they flow on the screen like water. You know? Just connecting with the themes of the movie. Things like the way wind moves and the way wind almost as if it's crawling to the air and just flowing and just like wind does. Air, you know, the card that catches at the beginning and then is used later is Arrow. And who shoots arrows, and the way the arrows move, just like pew, 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 and they're just like piercing. What's great sound effect too to add to it, but the way they move on screen, that gives that sort of, as if they're piercing the screen. Great use of artwork here. Again, artwork being this great verb that's going to help tell these story elements that are being told on screen, and just lending itself really well done. The action is really fast-paced and everything. So, I really enjoy the action on that standpoint. And last but not least, we have the backgrounds and special effects. And the backgrounds are so beautifully done. They're gorgeous. I mean, it feels like I'm deep in Hong Kong. Like I'm on Bird Street. Like I'm at the famous locales. Like I'm on that great mountaintop that's overlooking Hong Kong. So many great background visuals and so many great locations that are just drawn so extremely well. The beautiful art is just so beautiful. I could spend all day looking at the background and the location artwork of this film. It's just beautifully done. And yet still done in that card captor style. And again, when, you know, you have a very popular series that's doing a movie, again, you have the production value that's amped up and has more money. And so this is definitely like movie-like quality here, as opposed to sort of the overall series quality that lends itself to a lot more different buildings and making it feel more alive. And that's the thing that works the most here when it comes to how they drew Hong Kong. They made it feel alive. So really done. Really well done, I should say. And then the special effects, again, you know, the use of magic, and we're talking about the use of that in action, that lends itself to that, because the special effects with water effects and lightning effects and everything, and use of shadow, extremely well done. And the best way I can say that is, I focused more on action with magic and didn't focus on it as a special effects, mostly due to things like shadows and everything. Unless you're paying attention, you don't notice it. And that's when special effects are at their best, when you hardly notice it and you have to go back and like, I apologize, this was there and everything. So, art is just so extremely well done in this movie. It captures Clamp's beautiful, flowing style and the use of thin line work beautifully. It literally is Clamp's artwork brought to life on screen. So, animation is just amazing for this movie. So, with that, it's time to take a break. I'm going to play some promos for you for some people who do great work. And when we come back from our breather, we're going to get into acting and into story. So we'll be right back, folks.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, Michael Bailey here with a trailer for an exciting series of episodes of Views from the Long Box. To help me with this trailer, I have brought along none other than Darth Vader.
What is thy bidding, my master?
I had to pay extra for that one. Now, normally on Views, I talk about comics, either alone or with a friend. However, with The Force Awakens hitting theaters soon, I have been all excited for Star Wars. And with the sudden massive amount of free time I have found myself with, I decided to devote all of the December episodes of Views to Star Wars in a series I am calling
Views from a Galaxy, Far, Far Away.
Don't be too proud of this technological terror you've constructed.
Oh, that's kind of rude. I mean, I would think a Dark Lord of the Sith would be happy that I'm devoting a month of shows to Star Wars.
Don't make me destroy you.
Look, Vader, we had a deal. I was going to tell everybody about how I'm going to talk about my favorite Star Wars movies, my favorite characters and comics and toys, in addition to talking about The Force Awakens. You were supposed to back me up on this.
I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Well, fine then. Can I at least talk about how I am bringing some of the best and brightest in podcasting along with me on this endeavor? And that the show is going to be weekly through the month of December?
The Emperor does not share your optimistic appraisal of the situation.
The Emperor will be listening? Yeah. Then I will have to double my efforts.
Apology accepted.
I did an apo- You know what? Never mind. What everybody needs to know is that
Views from a Galaxy Far, Far Away
starts December 1st here at Views from the Long Box. You can find the show on iTunes or by going to www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Finally, you stuck to the script.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Views from a Galaxy Far, Far Away.
Starting December 1st. Only at Views from the Long Box.
Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like...
Gotcha, Mom!
Or maybe...
Dragon Flame!
How about...
Tatsuo! Ganida!
Or...
In the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash-landed on the planet Earth. Our most brilliant scientists and engineers spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember...
Our Star Blazer!
Or this?
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Gene, grappler ship's dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise! Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew. Home was a pen. Humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at twotruefreaks.com and on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. an unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it, as it's time to go over our cast list for acting. Starting at the top, Carly McKillop is Sakura Avalon. Matt Hill voices Kiro. Reese Huber voices Lee Sharon. Nicole Oliver is dealing double duty, as she is Mei Ling Lee, and she also voices the antagonist, Su Young, the sorceress. Maggie Blue O'Hare as Madison Taylor. Tony Sampson as Tori Avalon. Samuel Vincent voices Julian Starr. And Stevie Valance voices Yelan, who is Lee's mother. So just starting off the bat, the acting, I think, is actually really good for a dub. This is still sort of the early, almost Wild West days of the dub, you know, as we kind of talked about last week with Zoid Zero. So, you know, there are dubs that are good, there are dubs that are bad, there are dubs that start out bad, become good. But here, it's really well done. The voice work that is chosen for the characters is, I think, spot on. There's no flubs or anything. I can really see, as far as the matching of lip movements. But obviously, there were probably some here or there, because, you know, ultimately, with dubbing, there's going to be a time or two where you miss a lip flub, or you just can't match it for a reason. But as far as the acting is here, starting off, I love Carly McKillop's voice work here for Sakura. Again, bringing in those elements that makes her feel like an every person, you know. No, I hate to sound it like, oh, no, there are characters that are just too feminine. That's not the point I'm making. Or that they're too masculine. You know, it's, the point I'm making is, at the end of the day, it's not about that she feels like she's a character that is targeted towards any one group or anything. She feels like an every person in the way she speaks. And again, it goes to that connection, that character of Sakura feeling like an every person, feeling like I can connect to her, I can understand what she's talking about and understand what she's going through. And Ms. Carly does a wonderful job of portraying that through the voice. And once again, very much like, you know, animation and how the character designs help support Sakura's design and help tell her story while also telling their story, we get a similar thing here with the voice acting. Reese Huber was really wonderful as Lee Sharon. Again, brought this sort of brooding sense that made both Lee memorable and made him sort of a great sort of a rival and love interest and connection for Sakura. Again, very different attitudes and aspects and appearances that, again, that whole opposite and opposite attraction thing going works really well for two main protagonists here. Again, the feistiness that Nicole Oliver gives Mei Ling, again, the sort of superiority, like, I know I'm better than Sakura. I just wish I had a chance to show it. Come through really clear. And again, lends itself to her roles. Madison Taylor, Maggie Blue O'Hare as Madison Taylor. Again, that whole almost Sakura-like quality that we become no Madison for. As far, it's just sort of fun. It's like, oh, you know, and we're best friends. You can feel like her and Sakura are really good friends, even though she somehow always has a battle suit ready. It's like, those are sometimes the best scenes. It's like, oh, and I, for instance, in the movie, there's, as they're going to face the final boss, Madison's like, oh, you're going to face the final boss? Oh, and I just have just the battle suit for you. And then that she's pulled it out. But Sakura's giving it a look, and Carly gives it like, lastly, it's like, that's perfect. It's little things like that. You know, people think about dialogue and as far as these stirring monologues that tell you everything about the character. But sometimes it's those little things, those absolutely little things, like the way they laugh in a situation. Like, there's probably 20 different ways to laugh. And those 20 different ways would tell you different things about the character and their connections with each other. That laugh was sort of the perfect way to sort of encapsulate that friendship. But, God, that little creepy, just like, oh, you're you know, we've all had that moment where, like, friends do something that they don't know that they're doing. It kind of slightly embarrasses us, even if nobody else sees it. It's like, oh, boy. I mean, it's like the same way when people come over here and they look at my manga collection. And when I say manga collection, I'm not talking about my normal manga collection. I'm talking about that, let me pull out the drawers collection. he's doing it again. God damn it. so that's really well done. And then to encapsulate all of it, and I will say this because I want to end with him, but I think Tony Sampson and Samuel Vision do a great job as Tori and Julian. They're very funny together and everything, and they do great work. And Stevie Valance really has the great sort of maturity. She really does a great job of making Lee's mother feel like she knows a lot, and just like this veteran who's letting Sakura learn on her own. But the person I want to get to is Matt Hill as Kiro. God damn you, Matt Hill. We would love you in Gundam Seed as Kira. We love you in Ed, Edd n Eddy. We love you in so many things, but more importantly, oh God, how I love you here. You are just absolutely adorable and hilarious at the sheep time. You really bring Kira to life, and that's the point. He brings Kira to life, and Kira really is that foundational comedy that makes you laugh, while at the same time being sort of that information dump that's not overly talkative. At the same time, also, when he talks, he sounds interesting. So it's that thing to where Kiro's given a lot of information, is basically doing an info dump in the movie so Sakura can learn the things he needs so she can move to the next point of the plot. But Matt Hill has this great quality to make it sound so much interesting. And that just works on so many levels, you know? It's just so funny. I mean, and would you think of some more comedic scenes? I think of, and again, him, Carly, and the others do a perfect job of acting out when they're having lunch. And mind you, they purchase what seems to be like 46 steam bun platters. Like, how much money do you have, Tori? Really? How much money do you have? And can you spare some? But they do that, and, like, Sakura's, like, pick up, like, let's have this one. And he picks up the platter, and there's Kiro eating again. First of all, by the way, I want to know where the hell he, like, stuffs it all. But, like, why did you eat that one? And that whole gag that runs, it's just so perfectly done. And what really perfectly is when Sakura picks up the platter and he's not there, but he's underneath and they can see him, but Tori and Julian can't. But you see him, like, exhale it, and you can slightly hear, like, it's like, oh, you can hear that. It's perfectly done. It's those little details. Most people wouldn't even notice. They don't even know that they're hearing. And he works so perfectly here. Oh, I love it. He is just so funny throughout the... He's funny in the series. He's funny in this movie. I love Matt Hero as... Matt Hero. I'm confusing voice actors with characters. I love Matt Hill as Hero here. And let me breathe. I'll calm down. I'll get back on track. So I think he does a wonderful job there. At last but not least, we got to talk about the antagonist here. Nicole Oliver does a really great job as Soo Young. Again, as this vengeful lover who just won't listen to reason. And that's sort of something we'll talk about in just a moment with story, because that, again, that gets really into theme. But that overall theme, because she represents that sort of vengeful lover, so vengeful that she can't see the reality in front of her. And Nicole Oliver does a great job of portraying that sort of anger and frustration of feeling forgotten within Soo Young, and really helps make her feel like she is a formidable foe. So with that being said, let's move on to story. I guess it is time to go into it. I mean, that's a great segue to talk about her anger and her frustration. And going into, again, that theme of vengeful love and forgiveful love and things like that. And maybe a better way to put it, in a more sort of Japanese-like sense, is to put it in a haiku, in that the theme of today's show is that love is like water, in that it's ever flowing and never stops. It can be vengeful and take life, and at the same time be forgiveful and give life. You like that? That haiku is by Thomas Mattis. And yes, I made that haiku on the spot. And by the way, when I say haiku, I'm talking about the poem. Poetic sort of verses of... They're called haiku, not the wrestler haiku. Wow, here's a guy who went a long way for a wrestling joke. I'm talking about haiku, the Japanese poem style. Not King Haku, the wrestler. Because, you know, people always confuse that. But really, it's the truth. Again, the use of water. You see water in Hong Kong Bay. There's water everywhere. Her portals are water. Water's in the painting, the dripping of water. You see water everywhere. And that deals with sort of that thematical use here, that, you know, sort of love being like water, which is the ultimate lesson here. Again, it's that subtleness. And again, love is like water. It can be vengeful. It can be forgiveful. And you see the vengeance in Se-yoon's character, in this vengeful spirit that is just lashing out at anybody that's getting connected with Cloud Reed and the Cloud Cards and hoping to be freed. And again, so vengeful that it destroys everything in its path and doesn't even know it. While at the same time, like at that very end where Sakura... And in this sense, the ending is done very, very well. There's an issue with the ending I have. I'll get to it in a second. But that ending to where Sakura is able to break through and ultimately shows a defeat of her magic. And she realizes she's wrong, and she realizes what has happened, and she realizes that Cloud Reed is not coming back, and that her vengeance is all for naught, and it is not going to do anything to help her. And she's finally able to let go of this plane. You know, that last act of forgiveness. You know, where she's saying sorry as she disappears. And then ultimately how, to per se, the bubbles of that hold Sakura's friends come back, and, you know, as if her friends have been brought back to life. The water through the bubbles have come back and given life back to her friends. So we see that there. We also see how water gives life and can be very forgiveful of people's transgressions and past transgressions that happened on the land. in the way that, like, the port of Hong Kong is so... That came out really weird. The port of Hong Kong is so lively. That is one way it also shows how the water is forgiveful and gives life. Again, it's all those little thematic things here and there. The fact that water is a portal also tells you something. Not because love is an open door, and yes, I made that joke, and I want to kill myself for even making that joke. God damn it, it's too easy! God damn you, Disney! Ugh! Now that I've succeeded in wanting to kill myself, oh, that's gonna really hurt in the morning. Oh, that just, like, derailed every goddamn thought I had in my mind. Goddamn. This is why everybody hates Frozen. It derails everything. Okay, breathe. Breathe. Okay. But that water, where was I? I was at water was a portal, and how was it connected to life? Again, giving you life as you passed into another world is sort of the spiritual connection here of water giving life. But at the same time, being trapped in that world is also taking life. And again, the flowiness, the fact that they go into a world of water and yet can still breathe. So there's all these sort of thematic connections to love being like water. How it's vengeful like water. How it's forgiveful like water. And again, the thing that Cardcaptors does so well... And again, it's one of the reasons why I like it better than Sailor Moon, in a way. Is that it's so layered. And it's so subtle in the way those themes are told. Whereas Sailor Moon is so blunt about it. And again, I have no problem with themes being blunt. But again, it's blunt in that way of, like, here's today's lesson. Forgiveness. Whereas the way Cardcaptors does it, it's very subtle. Even if by my memory. And again, my memory, anytime I bring up the series, is from memory from watching it originally 15 years ago. Because I actually have not watched, like I said, the English version in years. Even though you can find both the English and Japanese dub. The English dub and the Japanese sub are both available on Crunchyroll.com. Which everybody should go to because they have a lot of great anime. Even though I'm doing this promo and I'm not going to get a check in the mail. but... You know, that's where the memory comes from. So, like, in the original series, it was always very subtle, even if at the end they would have that whole thing like Sailor Moon, like, here's what we learned today! It's like, and you ruined it! Thank you, Fox! Thank you for thinking Americans are stupid! Wait a minute. There are people voting for Donald Trump. No, I have to keep hope. I just wrote that big... long Facebook posts about how I have faith in the American people. I can't call them stupid, even though they're voting for Trump. Move away from politics. Moving away from that. Let's see, wait a minute. Social Security is the third rail. Education is like the fourth rail. It's like the bitchy presidential politics is like 27th rail, I think. There's a lot of rails that we're not supposed to touch when it comes to politics, is there? Wow, that came out forced. I'll be here all week, ladies and gentlemen. Let's move on to actually the overall plot, actually. So we can stop running into these roadblocks. Overall, the plot is written very, very well. And all the way up to the ending. And this is where I'll get into that whole ending, which I have sort of teased the entire episode. But what's really well done is the way they build everything up, way everything is written. Again, little scenes here and there, like her dream, where she initially dreams. Like, the series is starting off good. They capture Cardcaptor. But then she has that dream where she feels like she's being wrapped up and everything, and there's this mystical figure and everything, and then she wakes up. And then that tells you that there's something to foot. You were given info that there's this mystery, that there may be this bad person waiting for them wherever they go, wherever the movie takes you. And of course, you go to Hong Kong, and throughout the whole trip, she's given these little dreams where she's... You're giving inklings as the audience of what's going to happen. And again, they lay down those little threads, those plot threads, and layer those plot threads to prepare you for what's going to come by, like, the mid-movie, where we dive headfirst, really, into the main crux of the story, the main crux of the plot, and the main villain finally making her appearance. So again, they do a great job of sort of setting up the mood and setting up where they are and setting up how they got there. You know that her winning wasn't just luck. You know there's something more to it, but it's never mentioned until later. And again, they build off things. They build off it here or there and everywhere. And it's just so well done. And again, how they pace everything and how... Oh, it's nothing to where it feels like, you know, it's been 10 minutes, it's time for another plot thread to be dropped. But it's like, it's very well paced. It's, again, those layers and layers of plot threads that are laid down on, that all connect really well towards the end of the story, and everything feels connected. The way the characters interact with each other, again, really well done. All bleeding towards this force, this powerful force that feels to really overtake them. And ultimately, that's what leads to the end. And it's not that necessarily there wasn't there this big climactic battle, but the way they execute it, and I actually kind of in a way like the way they executed it, to where ultimately, the reason Sakura defeats and gets through to Soo-young is overcomes her magic. It's very much a card captor way. It's very much a clamp way for a final battle to happen. The problem is that they present Soo-young as so vengeful and such a powerful force that it's almost not believable that she would just give up. It's like their need and. Sakura gives this great speech, but it just feels like there could have been something more to really build to it. It's like, it's just, really, one time she escapes, maybe if she escapes and there's this sort of confrontation to where she can't believe she escaped, so water arrows or something water-like is being fired and Sakura has to dodge them. And she ultimately dodges them and comes out of the smoke and then has to talk. Maybe that, you know, it just like, it feels like small little thing is missing, and it, at the end of the day, it's just the ending, that ending just kind of feels very anticlimactic, you know? And that, it doesn't kill the movie, it doesn't hurt the movie, but it's one of those things where you're like, wait, it's over? And you feel like there should be more there. So, I think they ended that final fight too soon. And I think they could have done more to show Sakura ultimately overcoming the magic. Again, her overcoming her magic, not really getting any offense in, and, you know, talking her down is in the heart of what Card Captors is. But at the same time, I just feel like there could have been more there. More examples of Sakura overcoming her magic. And they could have built to it better. And ultimately, it just... It kind of hurts the movie in the way of it. Like I said, it feels a bit anticlimactic. And it feels like... Like, I've had all this build-up and built-up to all of this, and it's over. What? Right, what? It's over? And then they cut to... They come back... Next scene is them on the boat. Julian and Tori can't remember. You know, Sakura and Madison have this sort of moment. They look at the water. The water flows and cut the black and ending credits. And you're like, what? What happened? It's almost as if you feel like if you blink, you missed it. And I say that because I did blink, and I did feel like I missed something, and I felt I had to go back and watch it again, or at least the ending scene again. And I'm like, I didn't miss anything, did I? But yeah, that's ultimately the problem with the end. But the build-up and the writing and every scene builds off the other. It's extremely well-written, and all the build-up all the way up to that end and all the way through that final battle, extremely well done. And do a great job of building Soo-young as this vengeful antagonist, and then the climactic ending. And again, it's not the issue that she talks down Soo-young. It's that it feels like there could be more there. I guess lastly, the last thing I'll talk about is how this helps Sakura grow. I really do feel like it helps Sakura grow, because that's one of the things, again, the overall theme of water, love being like water, and understanding and growing your magic clean to sort of encapsulate that ideas. Ultimately, it gave Sakura a chance to showcase her maturity and showcase her skill and her use of the cloud cards, which helps her grow. And I can't remember if it's precisely used in the series, but it definitely feels like something to where, depending on where they put it in the timeline of that first cloud card arc, would definitely be helping Sakura. And, you know, that's the thing that I love about this series. Like, there are anime series where they have an anime movie to where it's basically a fun adventure, really doesn't add anything. Some of the Dragon Ball Z movies are like, I mean, and then there are some that do add something. I think this is something that definitely adds something if put in the proper context of where it is in the series. And so, again, the growth here is, there's a growth of Sakura being able to trust her magic, trust her ability to use magic, trust her instincts. All that is done extremely well. So that's definitely a plus with the movie, too, because it did help grow the character for the series. So, at the end of the day, what do I think of Cardcaptor Sakura, the first movie? Well, I think it's an extremely well-done and fun movie. A lot of great visuals. It brings Cardcaptors to life on a big screen with bigger art production. It's Clamp animation come to life. And just a really fun story, a great mystery with thematic themes of about love that are perfectly matched the series. The things that are not so good don't really hurt it. I mean, I talked about before. I talked about sort of the in movie songs, those pop songs, but they don't add anything. But they also don't really do anything to hurt the film. They're just there used in montage because of whatever reason. But they don't add anything. But the rest of the music is extremely well done. I gushed about the animation. The acting is really well done. And the story, up until that final battle, extremely well done. The themes of love being like water and being vengeful and forgiving at the same time, that theme is so beautifully layered into the movie in such subtle ways that it's wonderful to look at. And the story and the plot are just built and built and built upon. It just built so well that the ending ultimately feels a bit too anticlimactic. So it's something that leaves you in some ways wanting more, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing depending upon how you look at it. So at the end of the day, I give Cardcaptor Sakura, the first movie, a 4 out of 5. It's a really well-done movie. I definitely suggest you check it out. You can actually check it out right now, both the English dub and the Japanese dub, for that matter, on Hulu.com. Just go to the movie section and go to the anime genre, where you can find many great movies like Lupin the Third versus Conan, Lupin the Third versus Detective Conan, Lupin the Third movies, Detective Conan movies, just name a few. You can find the Magical Knights Raith movie, in fact, over there as well. And of course, you can find tons of anime over at the TV section on Hulu. And by the way, just like Crunchyroll, I am not getting a check for that plug either. But so 4 out of 5 for me, and that is it. Today's review. I'm kind of putting this out later in the weekend. I apologize for that. Again, I recently got some new toys along with schoolwork. So new toys plus schoolwork equals Tommy getting distracted. So I will have another review out this Wednesday. I'm pushing back. I'll tell you what that movie is in just a second. But so that's it for this review. Remember, if you have any emails or comments or anything, there are several ways to contact the show. One, you can email us at AppSolutionNetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page by searching Facebook for the AppSolution Network. And, of course, you can always leave a comment right here on the website at www.an.132productions.com. You can also make sure to check out all our other 132 Productions content. This, of course, includes my CMG's wrestling reviews, Tokyo SOS, Hexcast, which are some stuff I'm going to be putting on the site soon. Sometime in the coming week, I hope to have an episode of Tom's Tsunami D&D edited and released. Possibly a very blue episode of me and Edwin's intergalactic graphic review, which is mostly just us getting mad at certain things, but also gushing about TV series and everything. So all that and more, Shin Tiger Curl's wrestling and anime videos, John Romans's Toku videos, and much more. Also, make sure you check out our friends on the sidebar. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Views from Lombox, Steven Schleicher and the Major Spoilers Podcast, Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles site, and, of course, Scott Gunner, Tutu Freaks Podcasting Network. And that is it for today's episode. And probably around the time this is to be released tonight. Next episode, which will be hopefully released in a couple days, well, we're going to continue the month of love, and we're going to look at a movie I initially had plans on reviewing, actually, in October, because it's not only does it fit a love story theme, it's also involves a monster. But I think, as we all know, I didn't get anything out for about 5 months. But again, like I said, it's as dual threat. It fits October, but it also fits February. So we're gonna get French. Yes, that's right. I said we're gonna get French next episode as we watch a French animated film, a French animated CG film. As it is time to remember the stories of The Phantom of the Opera, Beauty and the Beast, and other tales of love and ugly. Because, ladies and gentlemen, next episode, we review A Monster in Paris. So, until next time, my Tsunami generation.
Find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.